Hello, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, filling in this week for Kathleen Dunn. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tensions in the East Central European country of Ukraine exploded in December when President Viktor Yanukovych decided to scrap an agreement with the European Union. It had been in the works for several years, and protests erupted amid fears that the country was turning east towards Russia instead of strengthening and growing ties with Western Europe. And just today, the Ukrainian parliament voted overwhelmingly to annul a national law that was aimed at curtailing the protests, and Prime Minister Mykola Azarov and his cabinet also resigned today. We will find out what that means and if it's a significant move in the situation in Ukraine as we talk with Professor Oksana Shevel. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Tufts University. She's also an associate at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies and the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. She's the author of Migration, Refugee Policy and State Building in Post-Communist Europe, and the book received the 2012 American Association of Ukrainian Studies Book Prize. Professor Oksana Shevel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's a big situation and one that outsiders have a hard time kind of keeping track of. So hopefully we'll be able to explain some of the background and what these new events today mean. I want to let our listeners know that they can join in at a different phone number than usual. We're broadcasting out of Madison today. That number is 1-800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Shevel, let's start back. What was the spark for the protests that began in November?
Yes, as you mentioned, I think just a minute ago, the Ukrainian government decided essentially at the 11th hour to suspend preparations for signing of the association agreements with the European Union and free trade agreement, which led to a protest it wasn't even a party-organized protest, essentially young people, many of them students, who came in support of the European course of development in Ukraine. So this protest, that was late November, these protests have gone on for about a week or so, and then at the night of November 30th, I believe, riot police violently dispersed, at that point, quite small group of young protesters, completely unarmed, who were essentially camping on Ukraine's main square. And the brutality of this police dispersal, which was broadcast on TV and on the internet, really galvanized many more people who were not partaking in this pro-EU protest before. And then 2 days later, we had mass rally, which led to some violent confrontation, again, with the security forces and more police brutality, when people were beaten up and subsequently arrested by police and charged with various crimes. And the opposition has demanded that, the perpetrators, police perpetrators of this violence will be punished, but Ukrainian government was not willing to take these steps. So the protest began with quite moderate demands, but as the authorities were not essentially yielding to any of these demands, protesters continue. And then I don't know if you're aware, but in mid-December, Ukrainian president signed a deal with the Russian president, essentially taking a $15 billion loan and cheaper gas prices. He did not sign openly to Ukrainian membership in the Russian-led customs union, but that was the fear that was yet another indicator of Ukraine's turn towards Russia. Then we saw more of the beating of the journalists, including prominent investigative journalist Tatiana Chernovil, who was brutally beaten by unknown thugs on Christmas Day, and that was the day when she revealed additional information on the lavish lifestyle of the president in the mansion his family was supposedly building. Subsequently, we had sort of the protest swizzled somewhat in size over the Christmas break, which in Ukraine, taking the Orthodox Christmas into account, kind of leads into the early January.
Right.
And then sort of just to mention the very latest events, so when the parliament reconvened after the holiday break, they passed this package of laws essentially establishing, many say, a dictatorship in Ukraine that outlawed protests, forbade things such as moving in a convoy of more than five cars, and introduced various other measures such as NGOs receiving Western funding to register as foreign agents, and the like. So that led to the further galvanization of the protests, which erupted violence. And today, as you mentioned, a step was taken towards defusing the protests, that this package of laws adopted on January 16th has been canceled. Although there is some speculation that some of these laws may be, you know, the government may try to readopt them. And then, right, as I said, the cabinet, the prime minister has stepped down. So that the negotiations continue. The parliament extraordinary session will continue tomorrow. So hopefully we may see additional compromises emerging in the coming days.
Well, let's back up a little bit and let's talk a little bit more about President Viktor Yanukovych and his policies. And is it any surprise that he is wanting to turn, basically Ukraine straddles the West and the East in Europe. And is it a big surprise that he seems to be turning more towards Moscow and the East instead of the European Union and the West?
Well, I think what caught people by surprise is that this association agreement has been in preparation for a number of years, as you mentioned, that all of the provisions in this agreement have been initialed by the Ukrainian government. So in a way, if there were some reservations, I mean, the official government position was that the agreement was economically disadvantageous to Ukraine. I mean, if you sort of think about it this way, this should have been known a long time ago, right? And some measures, you know, some negotiations could have been ongoing, or the society could have been informed. Instead, what we saw, sort of this like 11th hour reversal of the position. It is hard to say what exactly motivated the president to reverse course. I mean, a couple of things have emerged. One was that the requirement to release the imprisoned former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, who is in jail on, you know, what widely is believed to be a politically motivated charges of abuse of office. That has been a demand of the EU and officially was not removed. Apparently, the president was not willing to do that. But even more so, you know, again, the amount of financial aid that, you know, Ukraine was going to receive. You know, some cynical observers say that essentially what this government was concerned first and foremost is to increasing its political survival, and for that to receive substantial financial aid, as Ukrainian economy is in really dire straits. And the EU was essentially not willing to just kind of pay for Ukraine to turn westwards, and Russia has been willing to pay for Ukraine to turn eastwards. So that's essentially, you know, at the end of the day, that these two factors, the amount of money and, you know, sort of threat or less of threat of the political future of President Yanukovych that may associated with Yulia Tymoshenko may have played an important role.
And European leaders have been quite vocal about, as you said, this kind of out of nowhere decision to not sign those agreements with the EU, which have been in negotiations for several years. And at a European Union summit meeting in Vilnius, Lithuania, some of the leaders, especially Angela Merkel of Germany, were quite vocal about it. What are European leaders saying about, you know, basically Yanukovych backing out of this process?
Well, I think the position of the European leaders has been that this European agreement for Ukraine creates long-term benefits, right? It's not only, you know, the free trade that, you know, that yes, there are a short-term economic costs of adjusting to new standards and so forth, but essentially that's the pathway toward the rule of law, toward, again, various economic benefits for Ukrainian manufacturers. Ukraine trades with both Russia and the EU, and substantial amounts of Ukrainian exports goes to Western Europe. And also it's important to keep in mind that for people of Ukraine, they associate this European agreement, even though it wasn't even a promise of membership in the European Union, it was just sort of, you know, general trajectory, with things such as less corruption, more rule of law, accountable government. And that's essentially what galvanized protesters and continue to galvanize them, that these sort of broadly defined European values. So it is really for the people of Ukraine has been about values. And I think European leaders probably generally also may have seen it this way. But I think for the ruling government, it was much more about sort of material advantages and political advantages to their own political future. So that's perhaps why we have seen the course of developments that we have seen.
You said that one of the issues that the European leaders have brought up and the protesters have brought up, and even her own daughter has brought up, that former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko has been in jail since 2011, and many feel that it's on trumped up charges. Were there protests when she was jailed those 2.5 years ago?
There were some protests, but, I mean, again, she's not exactly a consolidating figure, you know, in Ukraine. I mean, there are some people who support her strongly, but, you know, many people who don't. And the election, that when there were presidential elections in 2010, when President Yanukovych won, it was a fair contest. It was a very narrow victory, but he did win. And, you know, when there are opinion polls of how many people support Timoshenko and how many people don't, she is quite divisive figure. So the amount of protests, specifically with Timoshenko, was much smaller than the amount of protests we see now for the European future of the country. Because things such as, again, rule of law, sort of lack of corruption, freedom of the media, individual rights, accountable government, many more people in Ukraine share those values than, you know, would specifically associate maybe them with the personality of Yulia Tymoshenko.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Kathleen Dunn. We are talking about the crisis in Ukraine this hour with Professor Oksana Shevel. She is an associate professor of political science at Tufts University. She is also an associate at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies and the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. We'll talk more about what's going on in Ukraine and especially what today's developments might mean. Today, the Ukrainian Parliament voted overwhelmingly to annul a national law aimed at curtailing protests, and also Prime Minister Mykola Azarov and his cabinet also resigned. We will talk more about that, and we welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Right now, we are talking with Professor Oksana Shevel, Associate Professor of Political Science at Tufts University, a specialist in Ukrainian and former Soviet politics and nation building. And we're very glad to have you with us, Professor Shevel.
Thank you.
And so we were just talking about President Viktor Yanukovych and his policies, his turn towards Moscow. Some analysts have said that this is another example of Russian President Vladimir Putin flexing his muscles and being a bit of a bully in the former Soviet bloc. Would you say that that's part of what's going on in Ukraine?
I'm sorry, can you say it again? President Putin doing what?
Whether President Putin of Russia is being a bit of a bully, and if that's part of what's causing the shift in Ukraine back towards Moscow.
I think it probably would be correct to say it is part of the issue, because clearly for Russia, Ukraine has always been very important, you know, not only sort of strategically, but also culturally. There is very strong, sort of consistent, persistent belief that goes back in history that Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus are really part of one sort of Slavic nation, and Kiev is the mother of, you know, Russian cities, so forth. So there are definitely groups around President Putin and in Russia more generally who would like to kind of see, you know, Ukraine at least remain in the Russian sphere of influence, if not outright, you know, form some sort of tighter political union. But at the same time, you know, Ukrainian leaders for 20 years have, as you said, always kind of balanced between East and West. And I wouldn't say that Russian factor was perhaps the most dominant, in the current crisis. If we had different leadership in Ukraine, the same Russian objectives and desires, may not have led to the same outcome. So I think Russian factors should be kept in mind, recognized as important, but I wouldn't at the same time overestimate the importance of Russia in deciding kind of events in Ukraine.
And Professor Shevel, we've been talking about the fact that this agreement that had been in negotiation with the European Union for so long was suddenly scrapped, and that President Yanukovych seems to be turning east. But is that really the only issue that has galvanized the protesters, or was that kind of a spark that lit up a whole lot of different areas of discontent for the Ukrainian public?
Yes, absolutely. I would say, especially at this point, the European, the agreement with the European Union is really at the back burner. And what has continued to galvanize the protests is essentially the abuse of power and the reversal of democracy and democratic procedures and rules in Ukraine. Since President Yanukovych took office, the Constitution of Ukraine provided for the parliamentary presidential form of government. When there was more of a balance in powers between president and parliament, he organized the reversal of this constitution back to the super presidential system. It was a very sort of questionable procedure how this was done, The judiciary has been completely under president's control. In the last few days, we saw a few judges who resigned and who basically say openly that all the judicial decisions are orchestrated from presidential administration, and any judge at any level is completely at the mercy for their job security on the presidential administration. Ukraine has become, I believe, the most corrupt country in Europe. Under the current government, according to Transparency International. So people have certainly a lot of grievances, even, you know, those people who sort of geopolitically or culturally are quite friendly toward Russia and may not even necessarily wish to see Ukraine, you know, turn away from Russia toward Europe. They're really frustrated and fed up with the sort of the abuse of daily life, the police brutality, the subservient judiciary, the extensive corruption of government. And these features, these feelings, are now galvanizing many more protesters than the desire to, again, sign the agreement with the European Union.
So, Professor Shevel, on December 4th, protesters occupied Kyiv's City Hall along with Independence Square, Kyiv being the capital of Ukraine. Was taking over both the City Hall and Independence Square, which was so important in the initial independence movement, were those symbolic or strategic, or do you think a little of both?
Perhaps a little of both, because, again, if we sort of keep the timeline of events, I mean, when people took over the City Hall, that was this essentially unplanned and kind of mass demonstration when people responded to the brutal beating of the students, the smaller group of students that were dispersed by police a few days prior. And then sort of large masses of people took to the streets, and then some groups essentially took over the building of the City Hall. It's also useful to keep in mind that Kyiv city government at this point, we can say, legitimately doesn't exist, because the election to the mayor has been postponed of the Kyiv city, and also the city council, also its term ran out and the elections have not been scheduled. So sort of the legality of the existing city authorities may be also questioned. But as far as the symbolic importance, I think Independence Square certainly has symbolic importance. Kyiv city government, I mean, the building of the Kyiv city government is probably more kind of, certainly became more of a logistical issue. This is the place where, you know, there are some, you know, people sleep, where there are, you know, food supplies, medical supplies and things like this. There are three buildings or even four buildings, I believe, that the protesters now control that are important kind of a logistical support. But the Independence Square itself certainly has a symbolic, not only from 1991, but also from 2004, when Ukrainians once already rose in protest against Viktor Yanukovych, when he was announced winner of the 2004 presidential elections, which were the results were subsequently overturned, and in the revolt he lost presidency to Viktor Yushchenko. So Independence Square does have symbolic importance, I would say.
And let's talk a little bit about the opposition. One person who has emerged as at least one of the leaders of the opposition is Vitali Klitschko. He's a former boxing champion. He's also the head of a political party that appropriately is called Punch. And he is assumed to be planning to run for president the next time that that's possible. Tell us about him and how he fits into the protests.
Yes, Klitschko, I mean, let me sort of maybe put him in the context of the opposition leadership more generally, because one of the problems, I think, that the current protesters have experienced, and which also is a big difference between the situation that existed in Ukraine in 2004 in comparison with now, that there is no single leader of the opposition, as was the case in 2004. Right now, we have three political parties that are in opposition, and their leaders, of which Vitali Klitschko is one. And then there is Arseniy Yatsenyuk of the Batyshchina Fatherland Party, which is the party of the imprisoned former Prime Minister Tymoshenko. And then we have the far-right Svoboda Freedom Party leader Tjernobok. So the three of them are sort of lead the protesters. And it's true that Klitschko, especially in the latest, I would say, week, particularly is emerging as probably the most recognizable and most likely person to, you know, win in the presidential context. Several problems with this happening. I mean, obviously, in Ukraine, events are changing so fast, it's hard to make predictions. But not long ago, an amendment has been passed in the Ukrainian parliament, and it is widely believed to be aimed at disqualifying Klitschko from running for presidency in 2015, because he has permanent residency in Germany and perhaps also in the United States. And this amendment essentially said that people who have permanent residency abroad, even though if they physically live in Ukraine, are to be considered as such who do not live in Ukraine, and therefore they cannot run for presidency because you have to live in Ukraine for 5 years permanently before running for presidency. So I think if there is a free and fair election, Klitschko definitely has a chance of winning for a number of reasons. First of all, because he sort of culturally, we can say, more neutral, he does have appeal. He's a Russian speaker. He potentially can appeal to both East and West Ukrainians, which, for example, would be impossible for somebody such as Oleh Stefanovok, who is a leader of the far-right Svoboda Party, whose base of support is in the west of Ukraine and has very little support in the east of the country. Again, depending how things go, if there is a free and fair election and Klitschko is allowed to run, I think he does have a substantial chance of winning, but that's looking, a little bit too far ahead, and it's hard to make a prediction that that's indeed what we will see happening.
We are talking with Professor Oksana Shevel of Tufts University about the current situation in Ukraine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Kathleen Dunn. We'd enjoy having you join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Shevel, you were just talking about where some of the other leaders have kind of strongholds and where the base of their support is. President Viktor Yanukovych's base of support is primarily in the eastern region of Ukraine. Have the protests spread to his strongholds yet?
Protests have been taking place in the east as well, but they've been numerically much smaller in size. What is also quite disturbing that over the past weekend we have seen a lot of violence in these regions, in particular in the Dnipropetrovsk, Zaporizhia, and also Sumy and Cherkasy, which are in the center of Ukraine. And this happens when a group of protesters, and it's really hard to say sort of to what extent, some of them were clearly local protesters, peaceful protesters, but there were also some radicals who tried to take over the government buildings in these regions, and then police responded with a lot of brutality. And what is sort of scary is that it wasn't just the police, but the thugs for hire that in Ukraine are known as tituski, the so-called tituski. There's video footage of police jointly with these thugs dispersing the protesters. We have some people disappeared, others arrested. So the situation is quite, dangerous there as well. But yes, I mean, to your question, definitely the base of support of President Yanukovych is more in the east of the country. And the protests, some protests did take place there, but they were numerically much smaller. So we can probably be fair to say that his support, he still has strong support in that part of the country.
Our listener, Ardith in Shorewood, emailed, "What is your guest's take on the regional divide in Ukraine?" She says, based on talks with her friends in Ukraine, there is support for the opening to the European Union from all parts of the country, and that really it depends more on age and a spread of new ideas. Do you think that it's more demographic differences than regional differences that kind of determine where people are on this issue?
From the polls that I have seen, I would say that both play a role. I think it is fair to say it is true that if you look at the support for the European Union among younger generation, people under 30, it is much stronger, and people in the east of the country, substantial part of also support, European course for Ukraine, even in the east, in this younger age group. At the same time, the opinion is quite split. One of the latest polls I believe I've seen, it shows something like 53% to 47%, 53% for the EU and 47% for, against and for membership in the Russia-led customs union instead. So this divide would be, the difference would be slightly different in the younger age group. But still, on balance, I think we do see regional divide and not just generational divide. As far as sort of the people lack of information, again, my personal opinion is that it would be a little bit oversimplistic just to say that, if only people in the East had different, say, more free media, they had access to internet channels and, TV channels that give more positive coverage to the opposition activities and sort of this pro-EU discourse, that they would change their opinion. I think that hasn't happened in the 5 years of the Orange Revolution, when there was, by and large, free media. This is not to say that some people may not change their opinion, but I think it would be a little bit unrealistic to just believe that, you know, people in the East could be made to change their mind. I think they have their beliefs, they have their preferences, they have certain cultural views, you know, they have strong pro-Russian feelings, and Ukrainian political elite has to learn how to work with this group of Ukrainian citizens instead of kind of suggesting that they could be somehow convinced to think differently. And unfortunately, we haven't seen the democratic so-called orange elite, basically, you know, elite around during the tenure of President Yushchenko, making policies that would sort of bring the East, you know, closer and the West closer, and kind of, you know, think of various measures that could be adopted that would bring two halves of Ukraine closer together. As far as what these measures might be, what we have seen a lot of talk in the last few weeks, and these talks continue, is change in the constitution of Ukraine to bring back the parliamentary presidential form of government, or perhaps even altogether parliamentary system, where there wouldn't be such a cutthroat competition for the top post of the president, and instead, you know, parliament, where again both parts of the country clearly would be well represented through the parliamentary election, would have more powers to decide on matters of policy, including foreign policy, cultural policy, and the like. And then, you know, that would be the platform for finding compromise solutions that would be appealing to both parts of the country.
You talked a little bit about the media, and while it's important, you know, having access to more media or different media wouldn't necessarily change the viewpoints, for instance, in the eastern part of Ukraine. But it is true that reporters have not been safe in the protests. As you mentioned earlier, on December 26th, the anti-government reporter and activist Tatiana Chornoval was severely beaten, and that set off a whole different, you know, kind of wave of the protests. She is also considered an activist, not purely a journalist, but how have other journalists been treated as they've been trying to cover the protests?
Yes, I think the treatment of the journalists is perhaps one of the most disturbing sort of features of these protests. I mean, the statistics I've seen just today that at least 43 journalists have been hurt in the protests. In fact, journalists allege that they've been specifically targeted by the police to the point of being shot at. Again, there is some disturbing video footage of shots being aimed directly at journalists and, in fact, also at the volunteer medics. Journalists even decided to take off identifying vests and hats, believing that they were specifically targeted by police. Some journalists were detained and beaten. And one of the demands that the opposition, and not only the opposition, but protests in general have, that even that those who are responsible for assaults on journalists in particular need to be brought to justice. So if there is an amnesty law that presumably would amnesty, you know, the protesters, but also the security forces, I think that would be difficult to sell sort of outright amnesty of security forces, given the information that we have seen on the targeting of the journalists, the beating of the journalists, and also the brutality of police against the protesters. I don't know if you've seen this video of a captured protester who was stripped naked, and then riot police took pictures, sort of trophy pictures with him. So these sorts of events really galvanize the protests even more. So I think the freedom of the media is one of the most important, was perhaps the only clear achievement of the Orange Revolution. A lot of the democratic changes that were achieved during 2005-2010 have been reversed since President Yanukovych took office. The independence of the media was one feature that has held on. And the fact that these laws from January 16th have now been repealed is a very important step, because these laws were severely curtailing also freedom of the media, the very broad definition of slander, criminalization of slander, of so-called extremism, the government being able to shut internet providers who haven't registered, who spread quote-unquote extremist material. So, you know, the freedom of media has been won back with the repeal of these laws. But the question, what would happen to those who have beat up and assaulted and shot at journalists, remains open.
And you talked about one of the very the gripping image of that protester being stripped and beaten. There are also some very moving photos of Ukrainian Orthodox priests that were shown praying between lines of police and protesters. It's obviously a very tense situation, and this very small group of robed Orthodox clergy in the middle. In general, what role has the Ukrainian Orthodox Church played in this conflict?
Well, I think, I mean, first of all, I would mention that the priests we see there, they're not only Orthodox priests, they're also Greek Catholic priests. Ukraine has this, you know, the church, the Ukrainian Catholic Church, which is, you know, I'm not going to get into history of it, but it's essentially sort of a merger, some sort of a mix of Ukraine, right. Catholic and Orthodox, right? So their clergy have been active there as well. I think the church leaders have definitely tried to diffuse tension. I think, you know, as you said, there are these many moving pictures of the clergy on the barricades. And in fact, the negotiations, they have urged both the president and the opposition leader to continue the negotiations. And I think that played a positive role, not least because at some point a few days ago, the Maidan, the people, the protesters, voted kind of by the show of hands on the square to suspend negotiations with the president because they believed the negotiations were not yielding any results and the president was just, you know, doing face-saving measures and not willing to offer any concessions. The church leaders, however, appealed to the opposition leaders to continue negotiations and they agreed to do that. But, you know, essentially the conflict would need to be solved by the political elite. Ukraine is a secular state, so the church doesn't have sort of institutional authority and, you know, legal authority to provide solutions to this conflict, but certainly the mediating role and sort of appealing to calm and urging a political solution and negotiations, I would say that has been a positive development overall.
We are talking with Professor Oksana Shevel of Tufts University about the current situation in Ukraine, and we will continue talking about that. We haven't even gotten to talking about the events of today, where the Ukrainian parliament voted to annul a national law aimed at curtailing the protests, and also Prime Minister Mykola Azarov and his cabinet resigned today. We'll find out what that means, and we'd welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maybe you have a question about how this conflict might affect the rest of the region. Is there a risk of a ripple effect? And maybe you want to know how the financial position in Ukraine might affect the euro or the U.S. dollar. And as I said, we haven't even gotten to the events of today. Join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we are talking with Professor Oksana Shevel of Tufts University about the current situation in Ukraine and what caused the protests and what might help them come to a peaceful resolution. Professor Shevel, thanks again for joining us today. One of the questions that I wanted to ask you is that, you know, it's not just the people on the streets that are debating whether Ukraine's future lies with an Eastern or Western focus. Needless to say, this could have a big impact on the economy, depending on which direction Ukraine decides to go. And so the oligarchs, we're used to hearing the term oligarchs in Russia, but Ukraine also has ultra wealthy businessmen who have a lot to say about which direction the economy should go. And what are you hearing from them about this conflict?
Yes, the oligarch situation, I think, is very interesting because obviously President Yanukovych is supported by some very powerful oligarchs, such as Renat Akhmetov, who's essentially his main donor and his main backer, and who controls about 50 members of parliament in the pro-presidential party of regions. And then there are other oligarchs, Firtash, Pinchuk, and others. And I think what we have seen today, this outcome when the parliament essentially voted to repeal the laws of the January 16th, and also Azarov, Prime Minister Azarov resigned, it clearly shows that at least for now, you know, the oligarchs decided that the confrontation that has been unfolding with the president not yielding to any of the demands of the protesters is not in their interest. That could be for a variety of reasons. You know, one, obviously, for business to function normally, it's hard to do it in the context of nearly civil war and, you know, the instability and violence unfolding. Secondly, there is now serious talk from the European Union and especially from the U.S. of sanctions, targeted sanctions, at the business elites, the backers of the president. Some of them, apparently, their visas have been canceled to go to the U.S., the business assets and business holdings of some of them in Europe are now under investigation. So that, again, you know, the oligarchs have their assets and their property and their villas and spend their vacations, invest in Europe. So in a way, turning away decisively away from Europe and toward Russia is not in there, we can say, personal and financial interests. So I think any kind of compromise and long-term solution would involve, I think, economic and political elites in Ukraine, you know, being at least some part of this elite, including at least some of the oligarchs, being behind this political compromise. And I think we're beginning to see the outlines of this happening. Another thing I would mention, and this is something that Ukrainian political commentators and journalists mention, is that some of the oligarchs and, you know, business elites within the presidential party may want to compromise, but are in fact afraid to show disagreement with the position of the president and sort of the official course. Many of the, you know, openly criminal or quasi-criminal individuals and sort of personnel plays, again, allegedly important role in the Party of Regions. And some Ukrainian journalists allege that members of the Party of Regions are openly threatened with harm to themselves and their families if they do not back the official position. Again, it's sort of hard to verify independently, but these rumors are very persistent. And given the background of many people, including, you know, current president himself, who has a criminal background, this is not a particularly far-fetched conclusion.
We're talking about the current situation in Ukraine with Professor Oksana Shevel. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Professor Shevel, today the parliament overwhelmingly voted to revoke a law that was specifically aimed at limiting protests. Is that a sign that the government feels that it's losing ground? Is this a big victory for the protesters?
I think it's a victory. I mean, I think that's definitely a very big, important step. And, you know, if you see any commentary today, you know, both from the European elites, from sort of within Ukraine, Twitter commentary, there is overwhelmingly positive response to this. Because these laws were essentially, you know, they were clearly going too far. The severe restrictions, both on the media and on the freedom of expression on the internet that they introduced, was taking Ukraine, essentially making Ukraine an authoritarian state. So the fact that these laws were rolled back, that's, I think, a big step forward. And again, as I mentioned, the fact that negotiations continue, hopefully there will be a broader outline of a compromise emerging. Because these laws essentially bring the situation back to where it was before January 16th, but they do not address the roots of the current crisis. And many of the roots of the current crisis lie in the concentration of power in the hands of essentially one person and one family. Yeah. And this is where, you know, an additional, an important step towards future solution to the crisis would be an outline of the constitutional changes that would weaken the power of the presidency and increase the power of the legislature. And apparently, talks to this effect are ongoing. Some say that constitutional processes will change, which is true. But in Ukraine, we have seen instances when constitution was changed as a political decision. That was the case both in 2004, when powers of the parliament were increased and power of the presidency were reduced, and in 2010, when the situation was reversed. So there is a political will. You know, the reversal back to 2004 constitution could be achieved, again, politically quite quickly, and then work could continue on sort of further refining of these provisions. So, you know, back to your question, I think the repeal of these laws is very important, but without changing the system, the roots of the current crisis remain unaddressed. So hopefully in the coming days and weeks, we will see further steps, you know, aimed at addressing the roots of the current crisis.
So as we were just talking about, the parliament today voted to revoke the law that was aimed at limiting protests. Also very big news out of Kyiv today is that the prime minister, Mykola Azarov, actually stepped down along with his cabinet. And he was really a focal point for protesters. They were demanding his resignation. And in fact, I believe that about a week ago, Viktor Yanukovych, the president, offered the prime minister position to a member of the opposition, which they turned down. But it also kind of made it clear that he was kind of hanging Azarov out to dry. How significant is it that Azarov has resigned, and why were the protesters so focused on him?
Well, I think protesters, I mean, again, sort of the resignation of Azarov may have been enough to, you know, again, appease the majority of the protesters several weeks ago. I don't believe today that would be enough, and let me briefly explain why. Again, under the current constitution, cabinet is completely subservient to the president. So the president appoints prime minister and members of the cabinet and can dismiss them at any time. So if, say, you know, Azarov is replaced by any other person, and this person, again, remains at the mercy of the president, you know, that's, again, doesn't go toward solving the solution of the crisis, at the roots of the crisis. Why, you know, why Azarov himself was such a focal point, I'm actually not sure. I mean, he certainly has been very widely disliked by the, you know, protesters in Ukraine, but I would say even more, even more disliked figure, or would be an exaggeration to say hated figure, is the current Minister of Interior, Zakharchenko, who essentially commands the security forces, and the brutality of the security forces is believed to be attributed, you know, directly to the orders of Zakharchenko. So now that the cabinet of Azarov steps down, you know, presumably all of the ministers would be replaced as well. I mean, president could reappoint them all. But it's probably, I would say, given that this concession was given, that Azarov stepped down, it's probably unlikely that the most, you know, hated figures, in particular, Zakharchenko, Minister of Interior, would be reappointed to the new cabinet. But again, you know, even though that's an important concession, because the constitutional structure is such that the cabinet does the bidding of the president, to address, again, the roots of the crisis, this over-concentration of executive authority, hopefully more would be done as far as division of responsibilities between branches of power.
And I want to talk more about whether there's a chance that President Viktor Yanukovych will resign. But let's go first to the phones and Anne in Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program and for having this wonderful guest. Such an important activity going on in Ukraine, and although the protests are very exciting and hopeful, I'm wondering about the underlying issue of economic dependency on Russia. And all Russia has to do is increase the price of gas and increase tariffs on Ukrainian exports, which they have done, to bring Ukraine to its knees and increase its already horrendous debt. And so then Putin can come back and say, okay, we'll lend you money to deal with the debt, but you have to do this and this, and probably maybe one of the requirements was not to sign the agreement with the West. How can Ukraine disentangle itself from this dependency that was deliberately, in my opinion, set up for political aims to bring Ukraine back into a union with Russia? So has the West helped at all in this regard?
That's a great question, Anne. And Professor Shovel, I think that's a very good question.
Yes.
Would those European Union negotiations have led to something that could have been politically or possibly as advantageous as a closer relationship with Russia?
Right. Yes. Thanks very much. Yeah, I think this is indeed a great question. A couple of things I wanted to mention in this regard. First of all, Ukraine's trade is more or less half and half divided between Europe and the EU. So it's true that Russia is a very important trade partner for Ukraine, but Ukraine also trades in Europe, so that's an important partner as well. Secondly, on the gas question, the main problem, the sort of the challenge that Ukraine faces is it has a lot of these very inefficient enterprises that date back to the Soviet period that are very energy, that consume very high amounts of energy. And in 20 years, 23 years now that Ukraine has been independent, very little has been done to restructure these enterprises to make them more energy efficient. So Ukraine produces some of its own domestic gas. So for example, it produces enough for the heating of the, you know, private homes and stuff. So it could meet its gas demands domestically for the citizens. The situation of the industry, that's another question. And here the question would be why, you know, I mean, I think the question the caller was asking is important, but also important question would be why so little was done to restructure energy enterprises, I mean, the industry, heavy industry, and to make it less dependent on Russian gas in the 23-year period. And, you know, many would say that this is because the elites that essentially managing these enterprises that privatize them oftentimes through dubious means and unfair auctions and so forth from the state budget. We're more concerned, and these are the oligarchs we're talking about enriching themselves and, you know, benefiting from dependency on Russia and reselling of Russian gas and so forth that Ukraine used to receive at subsidized price, then restructuring these enterprises. So I think two things may be worth mentioning here, that one would be that indeed, if, say, this conflict is resolved peacefully and Ukraine returns to negotiations with the EU on joining the free trade and the association agreement, maybe additional economic concessions, some kind of financial aid package before the transition period could be negotiated, but Ukraine has to commit to real reform. Because essentially, EU is not willing to just give the government the money that would be then misappropriated, and, you know, for example, used to win the elections to pay subsidies and bribes to people to vote for the current government. So, and the Ukrainian elite, on the other hand, would have to commit to some serious economic restructuring, which so far they have not been willing to commit, you know, the owners of these enterprises and the government of Ukraine. So, yes, it is a problem. But it is not, I don't think it's an insurmountable problem if there is a political will and also some form of financial assistance from international institutions for this kind of economic restructuring.
Thanks for that call. And you can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email a question or comment to talk@wpr.org. And actually, Anne's question, Professor Shovel, really made me think about the fact that these negotiations with the European Union were not actually for Ukraine to become a member state of the European Union, but just to have much closer economic ties and much more
Absolutely.
Collaboration. But what's very interesting is that certainly Vladimir Putin has not been happy about the number of former either Soviet member states of the Soviet Union or just kind of satellites of the Soviet world that have become member states of the EU. There's Croatia, there's the Czech Republic, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Slovakia, Slovenia. I mean, I think that from where he's sitting in the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin is seeing, you know, the edges of what used to be safely area that was oriented towards Moscow, much more oriented towards the West. And in some ways, do you think he's drawing a line in the sand with Ukraine?
Yes, I think in a way he is. But again, you know, we can say that, you know, if Ukraine membership in NATO, we can say would have been really like a red line, because that would mean sort of, you know, this military alliance moving to the borders of Russia. The association agreement with the EU, if there was a political will, you know, different ways could be negotiated. The Russian government was saying, for example, I believe that they were concerned that if Ukraine signs this association, then, you know, cheap goods from Europe would flood Russia. I mean, this is like an economic question that could have been, you know, negotiated by economic experts and probably some measures found to, say, potentially lessen the blow to Russia if indeed there was danger of this, right, if they, you know, they needed to protect their markets. But apparently we do not see this willingness to kind of address concrete problems that might arise. But it's more, as you said, this sort of geopolitical orientation as a losing Ukraine, right, which is the cradle of the Russian, you know, nation and Eastern Slavic civilization and this sort of thing. And maybe this is where EU and, you know, Russia sort of not only see their interests differently, but the whole perception of the situation is different if from the perspective of the European leaders. They say, look, we are offering this free trade agreement that is going to benefit you, you know, over the long term. Look at other countries, you know, they have, you know, benefited Poland and others. So yes, there are some kind of short-term costs for you involved, but, you know, overall, that's a good deal, and that's like an open deal we're offering you, and they're not going to kind of bribe you to take it, right? And then on the other hand, we have, you know, Russian presidents, when there are obviously various economic problems within Russia itself, and he's willing to just pay $15 billion to essentially, you know, keep his sphere of influence, right? That's very different sort of mentality and very different way of approaching foreign relations and, you know, foreign economic policy. So I'm sure the EU leaders probably now, I would imagine there is greater realization that maybe it should have engaged with Ukraine differently, that it should have maybe taken seriously Ukrainian government concerns about economic, you know, costs that they would have to incur. But then again, the question would be to Ukrainian government, if these costs should have been evident many months, if not years, before the November, you know, late November, when they decided to postpone the signing of this association agreement. Why would they initial an agreement that was so arguably economically detrimental to Ukraine? So again, the way that Ukrainian government dealt with this doesn't really inspire much confidence, I think, in the credibility of the official line that was given, that, you know, they decided not to do it because of the economic negative economic consequences for Ukraine.
Well, Professor Shevel, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. It's really been an enlightening discussion.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Professor Oksana Shevel is an associate professor of political science at Tufts University. She is also an associate at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies and the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. Well, coming up next, we are going to take a look at the cult of overwork, the fields in which it's expected, and if there are some changes afoot. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Thanks to KP Whaley and Bill Martins for production help. Stay tuned.